Hey, how's it going, everybody? This is Chris. Welcome to episode 54 of NML Crossing, where it's one of those kind of fitted in sort of days for me here. And it might be a choppier than usual. I mean, my episodes at the very best are choppy as hell. So hopefully I'll be able to disguise it as best I can. You see, it's only the first few days of April, right? But I live in Arizona, and April in Arizona is usually when you get your air conditioner checked out and tuned up. So there might be some noise. You might even hear the air conditioner in the background here because they're trying to crank it up and make sure it's running properly. But you don't want to be without AC in the middle of the summer here. We've had that happen a few times, and I tell you what, there is not much worse than trying to survive an Arizona summer without air conditioning. I don't know how they did it before air conditioning was a thing. I mean, I guess, you know, heating and cooling is in its relative infancy, right? I couldn't even venture to say how many years it's been. Decades, centuries, whatever it is. But people lived here without air conditioning, and I don't know how they did it. We were without air conditioning once for an entire week, and we actually had to move into one of those extended stay hotels, or motels, I guess, to make through. Other times, you know, if you're... the air conditioner always goes out at about 5:30 p.m., like when everywhere is closing, except for like the after-hours emergency stuff, which you're paying a premium for, and that's even if they can get out to you. So we've had, you know, a handful of nights without AC, and it's like the way you're sleeping on the bathroom floor because it's tile, and you buy a big box fan and you fill a giant bowl full of ice and put it in front of the box fan just so you can get a little bit of cool air going around. It really, really sucks. So all that to say, if this episode is choppier than usual, it's because the AC guy's here, and I'm going to have to run out and attend to him. And also, our dogs bark at everything. And I'm not talking about my feet. You know, the dogs bark constantly. So there might be some choppiness. We'll hope for the best. And we will hope that the issue we're going to be discussing right now is as good as the issue we discussed last time. So how about we hop on in? We're going to be talking about Batman, Shadow of the Bat number 84, April 1999 cover date. The story is called Fear of Faith, Part 2, To Serve and Protect. Written by Devin Grayson, with pencils by Dale Eaglesham. Inks, Sean Parsons. Colors, Pam Rambo. Letters, Todd Klein. Edits, Illidge, Vincenzo, and O'Neill. Cover price, $1.99. And wouldn't you know it, as soon as I get flowing here, the dog alarm starts going off. Let's continue. Now we open with the Scarecrow rummaging through one of the many, 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 many piles of garbage in No Man's Land. All the while, he's waxing on about entropy and fear, and, you know, that sort of thing. We eventually see what he's digging for. You see, he's looking for rats. But why? Well, he's doing so in order to contaminate the Ark's food supply. And it doesn't take long for Father Chris to discover the damage. You see, all of the church's food has been ruined, and there's nothing that could be done to save it. Now, Chris does for a moment wonder if they have enough clean water to spare in order to, like, wash the rats away, but they don't, so they can't. It's here where Johnny Crane starts playing the devil on Father Chris's shoulder. He talks about the things that can be done in order to feed the flock. Things that are unscrupulous and morally ambiguous. Things that Father Chris would never, ever, ever do. Or would he? Now Crane says that the flock will just have to be content to get their grand feast when they arrive in heaven. And they're just going to have to understand that Father Chris did his best. And with that, the seed has been planted. From here, we jump over to a false face territory where Batman and the new Batgirl are skulking around, narrating about the cacophony of Gotham City. Then, We hop over to the Blue Boys, where we meet a GCPD officer named Gruskin, who is kind of losing his marbles here. You see, he is beating the ever-loving hell out of a baddie, while blaming this baddie for all the bad stuff that's gone down in Gotham City post-Quake. Which, to me, feels like a natural sort of reaction, you know, given the circumstance and the ridiculously intense stress the cops are currently under. Now, Commissioner Gordon, he yanks Gruskin off the perp and tries to get him to settle his tea kettle a bit. Gruskin just starts repeating how crazy they all were for deciding to remain in no man's land. Meanwhile, the GCPD has claimed another block to add to their territory, so I guess not all was lost. We next rejoin Father Chris, where he's having a top-secret meeting with the Penguin. They're chatting about how they could be of use to one another. You see, Cobblepot's got himself an abundance of food and medicine, and Chris just happens to have a fallout shelter under his cathedral where maybe some illicit stuff could be stored. Now, the gimmick here is that Chris will store all the Penguin's surplus artillery in that fallout shelter, and Ozzy will he'll ensure that the entire flock is fed and cared for. Now, while they're having this dialogue, the Penguin is peeling an orange. And yes, we do know that fresh fruit is among the most valuable of resources in No Man's Land, right? Well, after peeling this orange, he feeds it to his pet bird, which shows us just how little he values, or even needs, the things that he trades and auctions off for insane rates. It's also maybe further proof that Ozzy's probably got an underground supplier, so he can get stuff into and out of No Man's Land, where very few others can. Anyway, Penguin says that the church is the perfect place to stash the stuff since, well, Father Chris has the trust of Batman. From here, Father Chris clasps his hands, closes his eyes, and starts quoting Luke 3:11, which states, "If you have two coats, you give one away, and you also share food with those in need." Penguin responds with the old axiom, "Desperate times call for desperate measures." Chris then hops into Psalm 37:16, which says, "The little that a poor righteous man has is better than all the riches of the wicked." Penguin responds with a Mark Twain quote about the surest protection against temptation being cowardice. Chris, we're volleying back and forth here. Chris then quotes Luke 6:30. And at this point, the Penguin is kind of sick of the back and forth here, and he decides to draw a line in the sand. He gives an ultimatum. He says, "Hey, Chris, you agree to this exchange of goods and services, or I'll kill you where you stand and I'll do it anyway." So, you know, I guess the decision's been kind of made for him, hasn't it? Let's check back in with the Ark, where our former Black Mask friend is having a grand old time playing a No Man's Land version of Red Rover with the flock's children. Scarecrow is there, and he's creepily looking on from a nearby darkened alley. And we see that the Huntress is on the scene, too. She and Crane have a little bit of a chat about Mikey. Scarecrow says the former maskers will likely be back for him, as they likely see he himself as a resource, and Gotham is, you know, scarily short on those. And he also kind of ribs Helena about how he, the Scarecrow, is an invited guest of the Ark, while they want absolutely nothing to do with her. Just then, Father Papaleo enters the scene with a hearty hello and chats Mikey up a bit. Before long, a group of rabbis arrive to admire the work Father Chris has put into the Ark Project Refugee Center. That almost starts like the beginning of a joke, doesn't it? Anyway, Papaleo offers them sanctuary there as well, should they need it. But, well, they turn him down, claiming that it would be against tradition for them to dwell there. Now, our man Mikey, he overhears all this, and he offers to build them a neighboring building, so that they can be to themselves, but still share in the protection and bounty that the Ark provides. He then explains that he'd always wanted to be a builder. Of course, that's before getting involved with the Black Mask's crew. Rabbi Sacharo congratulates Mikey on making moves in order to improve his life. Now, this takes us over to the rest of the former False Facers, who are, as luck or coincidence would have it, are currently trying to search for the Penguin's hidden cache of surplus whoozy-wutsits. And they're in a ramshackle tenement building, which just so happens to be infested by bats. Batman and the new Batgirl are there to bust some heads, and so that's exactly what they do. Batgirl even uses like a weird grappling gimmick, which like she's in the basement and she fires this like grapnel up into the floor and it caves in the entire first floor into the basement. Weird. Maybe overkill, I don't know. Just then, a fire breaks out. And it looks almost like spontaneous combustion, because who the hell would set this fire, considering everybody there is pretty much trapped? But it is confirmed later to be arson. Now, the false facers, they manage to get away through a busted-out window. As the smoke clears, Batgirl apologizes for letting them get away. But at least they weren't able to steal the Penguin's loot. To which, Batman informs her that the loot ain't even there anyway. It's been moved. And the fact that the place just went up in flames tells him that it was probably recently moved, because nobody would risk destroying that many supplies in no man's land. Batman suggests that the fire was set to hide the fact that there were, the goods were there in the first place and that they've been relocated. Which takes us to where those goods now rest, and it's, of course, in the fallout shelter below Father Chris's cathedral. Now, as he unpacks some of the crates, he's joined by a crane. The Scarecrow, he informs Chris that everybody's worried about him. And he also asks how the Penguin even knew that there was a shelter under the church, as he's always planting these seeds. And also, if when Chris was cutting this deal, if it felt like he was signing his life away to the devil. He asks about the emotions he felt in doing so. Did he feel fear? Did he feel anger? You know, all the bad ones. Did you feel all the bad emotions, Father Chris? I'm pretty sure he did. From here, we rejoin Huntress, who's running through a shifty part of town in search of those former Black Maskers. Now, she finds them, she kicks in their door, and pretty much tells them not to come back for Mikey. You see, the Scarecrow planted another seed. She tells them that Mikey's a good guy now, and he's under Bat protection. Which is all well and good, right? Well, maybe not. Because at that very moment, the Scarecrow is kind of having his way mentally with poor old Mikey. He tells Mikey that he needs to go back to the False Facers because, well, the Ark needs them for protection. Even Father Chris wants this, but he's too ashamed to come out and ask for it. He'd rather be protected by a gang and not the police, because many of the flock are refugees and illegal immigrants. Now, Mikey, he ain't the sharpest tack, but he's still not too sure whether he should be trusting a Scarecrow. So, Crane gives him a few well-worded questions that he can ask Father Chris himself. And he also lets him in on the secret stash of guns and ammo now being housed underground. And he claims that those guns are specifically for his former False Face friends. Now, the questions he wants him to ask Father Chris go along the lines of, hey, Father Chris, do you trust the Huntress? Do you not want the Huntress guarding the Ark? And are you afraid? Now, he also tells Mikey to inform Chris that he knows about the guns. And it's a pretty good plan, all told. Crane's gonna get exactly what he hopes to out of this. And we follow Mikey as he goes to chat up Father Chris, and the Q&A session goes just as it was supposed to. Father Chris does not trust the Huntress, and he does not want her around. He admits that he's scared, and he comes clean about the guns. And that's enough for Mikey to get, you know, be completely convinced. And so, the next thing we know, he's off carrying a crate of weapons over to that seedier part of town where his old running buddies are shacked up. He shows off the guns and he tells them that the Ark wants to hire them for protection. Thing of it is, well, these guys just got done getting an earful from the Huntress, who told them all that Mikey was one of the good guys now. And so, they take the guns and, well, they shoot him. We close out with the Huntress arriving on the scene to see Mikey laid out in the alley, barely able to beg her for help. There's also a little note pinned to his shirt that reads, "Traitor." As we zoom out, we see that the Scarecrow has observed this entire scene play out. And that is where we leave it. Next time out, the penultimate chapter of Fear of Faith in Batman number 564. So, now that the air conditioning has gone off, our tech just left, and I was able to raise it from 50 degrees to a more reasonable 75 or so. Let's talk about this one. I think I mentioned last time out that we were going to be following Mikey around a bit. And this is pretty much what I was talking about here. We get to see just how cerebral the Scarecrow is, and how pretty much every line that he delivers here is a seed being planted. There really isn't much wasted dialogue coming from Crane this time out. Everything he says has purpose, has meaning, has intention, you know? And I think it was very, very well done. Some of it's a little convenient. Some of it does lean into, convenience. The Q&A session that he had Mikey interrogate Father Chris with was, like, it had to be worded perfectly in order for him to get the outcome he wanted. All well and good. It worked, and it read organically. It's just, like, if Mikey would have changed the way in which he asked some of those questions, he would have gotten completely different answers. It's hard for me to explain it without, like, actually reading through the dialogue line by line, but if you're following along, you'll know pretty much exactly what I'm talking about. Again, I'm not gonna, if I were someone who graded things or gave things points, I wouldn't be taking any away for this. It was, you know, very well done, all things considered. But Mikey here, you know, we talked last time about being in this land of hopelessness, no man's land, and choosing that as your time to try to be a good guy, when all instinct and all benefits of being a good guy are gone. There really is no upside, you know, outside of your own integrity and the intrinsic goodness within you. So Mikey going from the relative security of being a bad guy to a good guy, it speaks a lot to his character here. And I really like how they're kind of parlaying that into Father Chris's sanctuary. You know, he sees hope there. He sees a place for him to improve himself. He talks to the rabbis about potentially building them a shelter, building them a home on the same campus, but separate, you know, respectful. I like that. I like that here. And I like that that Mikey's getting credit from the rabbis and from the priests for wanting to be better. We see him playing with the children here, trying to keep hopes up, trying to be one of the flock, not be the weirdo with the scars on his face and the tattoos on his face. He's a member of this parish or this community. And I like that a lot. I really do. Last time we talked about Father Chris and how, you know, when we read a comic book nowadays, we expect the priest to be all of the bad things, right? We expect him to be corrupt and perverted and just plain evil. Here we see Father Chris making a difficult decision, a bad decision. It's going to be a really bad decision for long. But he saw it as the only thing he could do. You know, to feed his flock, he needed to, you know, not to be too precious about it, make a deal with the devil. You know, he had to sacrifice his integrity for the betterment of his community, his parish, his flock. And it was all kind of put into motion by the Scarecrow on multiple fronts. You know, Scarecrow planted the rats in the food supply, you know, and he also planted the seeds in Father Chris's mind about, hey, you know, there are some things you could do, but you probably wouldn't do them. But they're there. They're available. It'd be pretty easy. The only hard part would be getting over yourself enough to do it. And we see, and we'll continue to see, that this decision is absolutely tearing Father Chris apart. You know, he is a morally good man, but he sacrificed his own needs for the needs of the many. You know, he sacrificed his own integrity, his own moral code, in order to ensure those who are counting on him can continue to count on him. It was a hell of a guilt trip that Crane gave him. It's like, oh, they'll just have to understand. Oh, you know, they'll get their feast in heaven. They're going to starve here. They're going to starve and die painful deaths here. But, oh, think of the bounty in heaven. And, you know, they'll know you did your best. Yeah, because you are doing your best, right? There's nothing you could possibly do to change this. It's really well done. I've mentioned it before, but Grayson's Nightwing run really soured a lot of people. I don't want to speak for a lot of people. Really soured me on her work. But to see how well-crafted this story was, it's very, very good. The only kind of nitpick I have is, and I don't even know if there's anywhere to like lay blame here, because it's an awkwardly choreographed scene, the one in the tenement building with Batman and Batgirl, where suddenly there's a fire. And it came out of nowhere. It looked very disjointed. It didn't have a really good flow to it. It was just like, here's a bunch of panels of fighting and action and fire. And I mean, that happens. It's not, you know, the end of the world or anything, but I don't know if that speaks to inexperience in writing action scenes. It may be inexperience in drawing action scenes. I mean, it may just come down to miscommunication or a cross wire in the script or the plot notes or however they constructed this comic. But overall, taking that out of the equation, I mean, it still got the job done and everything else was really, really good. So this one's definitely going to get a recommendation. Definitely worth checking out. This is one of the handful of stories that were included in the abridged versions of the No Man's Land trades back in the long ago. I want to say No Man's Land Volume 1, the abridged version from 2000 or so, that one includes the four parts of No Law and a New Order and the four parts of Fear of Faith. So definitely, I mean, I'm sure you could find that thing for next to nothing if you wanted a physical version of this on your shelf and didn't want to spring for the giant omnibuses, which look absolutely gorgeous, but I worry they'd be hard to read. I only own one omnibus. I own the Grant Morrison New X-Men omnibus, and the day I got that, I got it at a half-price books, and I had a coupon, so I think it's like a $100 book, and I think I got it for like $15 after like coupons and the half price thing. And I remember getting it home and I was excited to check it out, and it was so hard to read because it, like, it weighs 15 pounds. It's the size of a table. It's hard to read. It looks gorgeous. It looks super cool, but not the easiest thing to read, at least for me. At least for me. It's not my preferred way. I love having them on my shelves, but actually having them in the lap and turning the pages, that's a toughie. But I think that's all we have to say about this issue. Worth a look, for sure. Let's hop into the mailbag before we get out of here. We're going to start with our friend Chris Yu, who's chatting up Chapter 1 of Fear of Faith, and he says, I remember thinking it was weird having an issue of Legends of the Dark Knight that was set in continuity. This cemented the fact that DC was all in on this No Man's Land story. You weren't going to get any kind of Batman story that wasn't involved in No Man's Land. And it's true. Legends didn't tie in very often. You know, Legends is such a weird series. Because it started, if I'm not mistaken, with kind of like, you know how we did our X-Men vignettes where they were like slotting stories into like old bits of X-Men history? It was kind of like that, right? I mean, you had the Venom story arc, you had the masks, you had all those like seminal ones from the early days of Legends of the Dark Knight. Then you'd get like some Elseworlds, some way out of continuity stuff. And then you get some more backfill from past continuity, and then you'd get something that was like right there. Like during the Nightfall, Night Quest, Night's End series, Legends of the Dark Knight was part of that. You know, that was weird. Because I think that was the first time I ever bought an issue of Legends of the Dark Knight. It was like the second or third to last a chapter of Night's End, and I think, I don't even know why I bought it, because I didn't buy much of that, but I bought that one. I must have just liked the cover or something. I'm sure it was Batman fighting, you know, Azbats, but I remember thinking it was really cool. And then Legends would go back to doing its own thing while the rest of the books did theirs, and now here we are in No Man's Land, where no book is safe. You know, every book is going to be part of this now, and that's, I like that. I do like that that shows that they're all in. Of course, there are going to be miniseries. I mean, you can't get a week without at least one Batman miniseries, right? So I'm sure there are going to be miniseries that are not No Man's Land-centric, which I totally get. I mean, DC, as we've said, this is a gutsy, gutsy move to take one of your premier hero families and totally turn their world upside down. You know, so some people may, and you know, we've seen the receipts on Usenet where people are saying, I'm dropping this. I can't do this story. I can't spend a year in No Man's Land. But, you know, be that as it may, I'm sure people are still Batman fans, so they're going to have some stories for them in the miniseries realm. And of course, there'll be countless Elseworlds and whatnot. And on that note, I know I'm late to most things newsworthy, but I guess they're bringing Elseworlds is back with a follow-up to Gotham by Gaslight. I don't know how I feel about that. I feel like Elseworlds really had a place back in, you know, the 90s and 2000s when continuity sort of kind of mattered. Now you have so much stuff that doesn't. I mean, have we figured out what Black Label is yet? It's been around for like 6 years. Do we know what it is yet? Is it in continuity? Out of continuity? Do we pick and choose? Of course we pick and choose. We pick and choose everything. So I wonder why Elseworlds is outside of just the throwback nostalgia, but, you know, with the name, I don't know why they're making any kind of big deal about it. Anyway, back to Chris. He says, how about those poor Somali refugees? They fled their home country just to come to Gotham City as it was cast out of the USA and turned into no man's land. They may have been better off staying in Somalia. That's a very good possibility, isn't it? Chris continues, it's nice to see the Huntress. She's been a favorite of mine going back to the Earth 2 Helena Wayne days. It makes sense that she would have stayed in Gotham with her family's ties to Gotham. I'm interested to see where her story goes from here. And honestly, I am too. I mean, there's one really big shoe dangling right now. It's about to drop. But outside of that, I really don't know what might happen with her story here. I think when I look back at Huntress, I think I mentally conflate her with Renee Montoya, because she's going to have a pretty good story with Two-Face, and whenever I look back on it or think back to it, it's always Huntress and Two-Face. And I know it's not true, but that's just what I see. So after the shoe drops, I am also very curious about where her story goes from here. Chris wraps up with, I was thinking that with all the tagging going on by the various factions, the most valuable thing in Gotham should be spray paint. And you know, talk about not seeing the forest for the trees here. I never thought about, like, hey, where are they getting all the spray paint? You know, we're selling our souls for a slice of apple, but spray paint, they're using that willy-nilly, you know? Using it like it's going out of style, like there's no end to it. They're using it just to draw lines through other people's tags. So I do wonder. Maybe somebody drops, you know, crates of spray paint in. I don't know. But a very, very interesting point. Until I read this line in your message, I did not even consider. So thank you so much for writing in, Chris. It's always a treat to hear from you. And I love the fact that you just raised a point that I never thought about. That's really, really cool. Let's do one more before we go. We're going to talk with our friend Walt here, who sent me a text not too long ago. And he's talking about the graphic novel trade paperback deal here. He says, I'm not sure where I stand on graphic novel as a term. I feel like coming from many, it is pretentious. I think it depends on the context and the person and the tone. And you know, I couldn't say it any better myself. I think I mentioned a few episodes ago that, like, it really got under my skin when you know, some teenager saying, I don't read comics, I read graphic novels. And that just bothered me. Really, really bothered me. So yeah, the tone, the person, the context, that all matters. That all matters. Walt continues, I forgot about Dickens and Doyle on serialized novels and magazines. I should probably know better, recently diving into Conan. And most of the original stuff was in a magazine before being collected into book format. And that's true. I mean, that's, I think it was Professor Allen who brought that up. And it's weird. It's stuff that I knew because, you know, all the jokes about Dickens being paid by the word in the serialized stories. Great points. Very great points. Walt continues, I suppose there's also intent. Back before the collected editions were so ubiquitous and nearly every issue was a standalone, or the focus of a specific story was a certain plot thread, the book would not be a graphic novel, but a collection of stories / issues. Now that opens a whole other can of worms, doesn't it? Like, what would we say of, like, Sons of Marvel Origins, or the Origins of Marvel Comics and the Sons of Origins of Marvel Comics? Would we call that a graphic novel? Would we call that a trade? Would we call it a collected edition if it's not all one story? If it's just like Amazing Fantasy 15, X-Men number 1, Fantastic Four number 1, would that be a, what would we call that? Would we go back to the old terminology and call it a graphic album? Wasn't that weird? Back like with the Comics Journal and like all those awards back in the day, it's like Best Comic Album. Which I guess makes sense, you know, if an album's a compilation of songs or of anything, I suppose. Would we just call that a graphic album? And if we did, could we ever possibly convince a single other person to do so? Probably not. Walt continues. With decompression, where they obviously are being written for the collected format, eh. To which I say, remember everybody, there's no such thing as decompressed storytelling. That's all in our minds. That's a shared delusion. Just because every story was suddenly 6 issues long, and every trade was 6 issues long, and then with shrinkflation, every story became 5 issues long, and every trade became 5 issues long, that doesn't mean anything. That does not mean anything. We are all imagining it. It's a shared delusion. Walt wraps up with, I'm also easily swayed when presented with stuff and may even talk myself from one position to another in reasoning out the first. And I'm glad I'm not alone in that. I am a pretty obnoxious fence sitter. And I am a people pleaser. And I don't like to disagree with anybody. And like I said a few episodes ago, when I'm presented with sense, I will usually come around to the sensible opinion or decision. With this graphic novel versus trade versus, I guess now, graphic album, I'm upside down with it. I can go any which way but floppy is my point of view in comic book terminology, I guess. But thank you so much for writing in and sharing your thoughts, Walt, and also for being one of my few sounding boards this past few weird and wobbly days and weeks. So thank you so, so much. But I think that'll do it for our mailbag. If you'd like to be a part of the mailbag, I invite you to do so. You could find me all those different ways. Chris is on infiniteearths.com, chrisandreggie.podbean.com, weirdcomicshistory@gmail.com, and Facebook, Twitter, X, yada, yada, yada. But with all that having been said, I'd like to thank you all so much for choosing to spend some of your day with me today. And until next time, as always, I'll talk to you again real soon. See ya. Do not fall out of love, we double down.